Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama headed to the Far East today on a big trip with tempered expectations to a vital region. Troop talks in Tokyo, trade in Seoul, a push to reassert America's Asian commitment in Singapore, and overall, a big visit to China, where climate change, trade flows, American debt, the dollar, and an East-West balance of power are all on the table. This hour On Point, Obama goes to Asia. You can join the conversation. What would you put at the top of the president's Asian agenda, his China agenda? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few minutes, we'll get a Chinese perspective from Shanghai, where the president arrives next week. But joining me first today from Lincoln, Nebraska, is Susan Shirk from the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. She ran China policy in the second Clinton administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. She founded the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, a forum that right now is sponsoring high-level back-channel talks between North Korea, the United States, and more over Korean Peninsula nuclear issues. Her latest book is China, Fragile Superpower. Susan, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Tom. It's nice to be with you.
And from Washington, James Fallows is here, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's been covering East Asia for more than two decades now, just finished a three-year stint living in China. His latest book is Postcards from Tomorrow's Square. Jim, welcome back to On Point and the United States.
Tom, thank you very much. It's very nice to talk with my friend Susan Shirk, too.
It's great to have both of you. Shending Li will join us from Shanghai in China in just a few minutes. Let's listen to just a little bit of President Obama this morning, just before heading out to Asia on Air Force One, saying the administration is continuing to work to revive the economy, but he'll talk about issues on his Asian trip that are also vital to recovery.
In the coming days, I'll also be meeting with leaders abroad to discuss a strategy for growth that is both balanced and broadly shared. It's a strategy in which Asian and Pacific markets are open to our exports, and one in which prosperity around the world is no longer as dependent on American consumption and borrowing, but rather more on American innovation and products. It's through these steps with our partners, in addition to the work we're doing here at home, that we will not only revive our economy in the short term, but rebuild it stronger in the long term.
President Obama this morning getting ready to get on Air Force One and head out to Asia. Susan Shirk, step back for a second. We'll look at China in particular, but he's going to be up and down East Asia over the next week. When this part of the world looks at the United States now, do they still see the big leader, a big number one leader? What's the perspective? Is the U.S. still it?
Well, I think Asians still respect the United States tremendously, but there certainly are some chinks in our armor, some question marks out there about our economic system and our economic viability in the future. There are always question marks about America's security commitment to Asia because, of course, we're thousands of miles across the Pacific. But for many decades, we have been the dominant military power in Asia. Mm-hmm. So there are always question marks about our staying power. And I think that's why the president's visit is so important, because we've got to get out there. We've got to show our commitment to Asia. And that's the main message of what he's doing this week.
Jim Fallows, here's a headline from MarketWatch. Which in a funny way says a lot. Obama to tell Asia, U.S. is in the game, as if there were a question about that, James, something that needs asserting.
Well, what's interesting to me is we start back the time when you and I, Tom, were both reporting from Japan 20-plus years ago, at least for that period and probably for 10 or 15 years before that, there's been this question of, is the U.S. really in Asia militarily, as Susan Shirk was saying, economically, is the U.S. on the rise, is the U.S. on the decline? Certainly, it's true that in relative terms, the Asian economies have more heft now than they did 20 years ago or certainly 50 years ago. My impression is there's a sort of nervous tick that builds into a lot of the the Asian world discussion about, oh, is the U.S. really here, both either economically, politically, or militarily, whereas, in fact, the U.S. still does have tremendous weight there. And trips like this are probably worthwhile for reasserting on the Asian side of the equation that the U.S. is still a major power, a major economy, a major force in that part of the world, and is thinking about it.
Susan, look at Northeast Asia for a minute. You pay attention there. In Japan, we have a new government not elected long ago, which is not as sort of knee-jerk warm to the United States as its predecessor, and talk there about where U.S. troops and facilities should and should not be in Okinawa, for example, where there's a huge U.S. military presence. In Seoul, there's a free trade agreement that's been on the table, no certainty at all that that'll be worked out on this trip. Before we head on to China and Southeast Asia, but looking at Northeast Asia, how do you see the agenda, Susan?
Well, it is interesting that the sharper potential conflicts are with our allies, Japan and South Korea, rather than with China, actually. Mm-hmm. As you noted, this free trade agreement is really going nowhere in Washington because President Obama has such an ambitious domestic agenda and Afghanistan and Iraq to worry about. So he doesn't want to put a new free trade agreement before Congress, which he knows will be politically very controversial, a very tough sell. With Japan, there is this new government, and the government made some election promises. Of course, we're familiar with this dynamic, right, of kind of overselling during the presidential campaign. And now we want to give the Hatoyama government some time to really think through what it wants to do. So they're going to shelve that dispute about the Okinawa base while the president is there. They won't deal with it very much at all, I believe.
Jim Fallows, just looking at Korea and Japan for a minute, and maybe taking our eye on down to Southeast Asia, are these countries that want the United States to remain big and strong and even economically and militarily in Asia? Is that the counterbalance to China or balance that they're looking for?
I think that while you could make theoretical arguments that in the long run it's unnatural and unsustainable to have the U.S. 7th Fleet and the whole U.S. military power be essentially the balance wheel among China and Japan and the Koreas and Pacific Russia and Southeast Asia too, and perhaps India, while you could imagine a more logical arrangement, I think there is some comfort for everybody in thinking that's the status quo for now, that all the various moving parts in that equation have less immediate reason to mistrust the U.S. as the exerter of power than they would any of the alternatives. So I think that also, since so many of the economies there are geared towards export production to the U.S. market in particular as the kind of differential way to get their economies revved up, there are important factors that the U.S. plays there. So I guess it's striking that while there has been a fair amount of cackling over the years about U.S. decline in area X, Y, and Z, I think it's in the interest of most of the parties there to have the U.S. be viable enough to play both the military and the economic role.
And then, Jim, turn to China. You've been writing recently about how, interestingly, in some ways, China's situation today is kind of like the situation of the United States in the 1920s and maybe even 30s. What's the parallel?
Well, the parallel is one that a man named Michael Pettis, who's an economist at Peking University, laid out early this year when the real collapse of employment was happening in China. And the shortest way to make his point is that through the 1920s, the U.S. was essentially the China of that era. It had a trade surplus with everybody in the world. It was piling up these huge reserves. And so when employment shrank catastrophically with the Great Depression in the 1930s, the loss of jobs was worse in the U.S. than it was anyplace else. You know, the overall consequences were worse in Europe, but the job loss was worse in the U.S. because it had most to lose. That was China's situation as well. It had a disproportionate share of the world's manufacturing jobs, and so it had more to lose. And that was when you had tens of millions of jobs that were eliminated in China, and the government's been scrambling since then, largely successfully, to find ways to find other stimulation for the economy of buying people off with different kinds of benefits and avoiding the rural upheaval, which ironically is what a communist government most fears in China.
Susan, China had that challenge, but now they've got they're on track, we're told quite confidently, for 8% growth in GDP this year. Does that mean they don't need much from the United States. You said, you know, expect warm words, but not much more when President Obama sits down with China's leaders.
No, they certainly still need an open U.S. market, and they also still need a good working relationship with the United States instead of a hostile Cold War situation. So I think they have a renewed appreciation of their interdependence with the United States, as here in America, we have a renewed appreciation of how much we depend on China.
But you're right, the era when China made all the compromises in the relationship has passed. That sounds pretty definitive.
Well, we certainly need each other, which means there's got to be give and take. When I was in government in the second Clinton administration, the agenda of discussions was mostly bilateral issues like nonproliferation, human rights, and then we were trying to get China to join the World Trade Organization and open up its domestic markets. Well, many of those bilateral issues, human rights, and, well, certainly nonproliferation has basically been solved. China is no longer a big proliferator. They're working with us and
on the nuclear front.
On the nuclear front, mm-hmm. and the missile front, mm-hmm. as well.
Though their military is growing quite dramatically and steadily.
That's right. Their own domestic military. But in terms of selling weapons of mass destruction all over the world the way North Korea does, for example, is not something that they're doing anymore. So now economic issues and trade have risen to the top of the bilateral agenda.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's big trip to Asia and the U.S. agenda with China and its neighbors. The president off today, stopping in Alaska, and then right on over the next week to Tokyo, Singapore, Shanghai, Beijing, Seoul in South Korea. Susan Shirk is with us today from Lincoln, Nebraska. She's at the University of California, San Diego, and has been right in the middle of China policy and Asia policy for a long time. James Fallows is with us, correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, just recently back from China, where he spent 3 years. His latest book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square. We're joined right now as well from Shanghai in China by Professor Shen Dingli, professor and executive dean of Fudan University's Institute of International Studies, director of Fudan's American Studies program. He's a fellow at the Asia Society based in New York. But he joins us today from Shanghai, and we're very happy to have him. Professor Shen, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to talk with you again. Give us some China perspective on President Obama coming out. Is this a big deal for China? Are there urgent issues on the table that you expect to have solved from the Chinese side? What's the agenda, Professor?
I think we expect President Obama will visit China with a variety of important issues to address to Chinese audience. The Chinese leadership, the people, the media, the young future leaders. And these issues to be discussed would cover some very important, timely strategic issues. How to position the two countries in the world in the changing time, when they are collaborating, fighting a financial crisis, curtailing international terrorism, as well as the spread of weapons of mass destruction. The two countries share fundamental common interest working together. But they also are meeting with some problem concerning the fairness of the bilateral economic partnership. While generating new wealth collaboratively, how to share, how to divide the wealth, how to pay the cost, how to pay the responsibility in the international system. And for this, we expect that President Obama would address to Chinese leadership in terms of the U.S. concern. The U.S. Would hope that China would listen to Americans' concern and would understand and sympathetic and would take Chinese initiative to respond.
Let me ask you, if I may, Professor Shen, on just a couple of specific points. First, on Currency questions about the Chinese yuan in particular. You know, a lot of U.S. manufacturers have complained that saying Beijing artificially holds down the value of the yuan to make its China's exports cheaper, and that makes American goods more expensive for Chinese consumers. President Obama has said he will raise that issue along with others. Is China likely to be ready to respond, to give him something or not?
Well, I think this summit meeting in Beijing would offer the opportunity for two presidents to discuss this issue. Because each country has a different developmental situation and a stage. Personally, I don't expect that China would fix this issue to the U.S. interest immediately. China has its own problem. China has 1.3 billion people. It needs to sustain economic development bigger than 5% at least to meet the huge domestic need. And then the 8% will meet China's legitimate need and also to offer its some growth. At this low level, when you see 8% is great, in terms of Chinese eye, it is moderate enough.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I think China might not be in a great position to help America to fix this quickly. But in my personal view, if the U.S. could improve its economy after 6 months or 9 months, and then China might be in a better position to work with the U.S. on this issue.
Susan Shirk, how do you see this one? The Chinese leadership has not been shy in this year about almost lecturing the United States on the economic front, saying, you know, get your house in order, get your debt in order. Yes, we've got issues, but you've got big, big issues. Is President Obama likely to get some talking to in Beijing, Susan?
Well, I think he might, although, of course, the Chinese leaders will be very polite. Mm-hmm. And I think, actually, the Asian leaders meeting in Singapore, I understand, are also going to raise questions about the U.S. deficit and potential inflation, a post-recovery inflation, which would reduce the value of all those dollar reserves that are parked in U.S. treasuries that China and other countries. Mm. Right. So some of that is defensive on China's part, like pointing fingers at us so we won't point fingers at them, or at least to we're pointing fingers at one another. Mm-hmm. But some of it is, you know, a real concern on their part about these reserves. So that's why I think actually they are going to start appreciating their currency again. They had done it for about 20%, and then as the financial crisis clicked in, they pegged hard to the dollar, so it's been, joined at the hip mm-hmm. with the dollar. But that's there are some indications that very soon, if not already, they're going to start gradually appreciating the currency again. Because these big reserves, we look at them as a sign of power. Mm-hmm. But as James Fallow said, talking from some of the arguments that Michael Pettis makes, they're actually a huge burden to China.
A kind of vulnerability.
They are. And they would it's very costly for them to keep sterilizing all of these earnings and trying to find some place to put them. So I think they will gradually start appreciating their currency, and we definitely need to rebalance the relationship, but it has to be done gradually so it doesn't shock either the Chinese economy or the U.S. economy. Mm.
Jim Fallows, I want to come to you on that. And Shending Li, please stand by in Shanghai, but we've got callers here in the United States. Hing in Boston. Hing, you're on the air.
I just want to say that there will be a very strong synergy between USA and China. And I just been born in China, but I've been go back and forth for helping China. And because I think they need to a lot to catch up. And China have more people, in other words, more patient and more consumer, and like onion, layer and layer. And they really helping to, you know, to learn from USA. And they have more talent and hardworking people, and they can in helping American good idea to execute in China. And they really, even though more competitive, but I do believe they can inspire more U.S. students to work harder and then to be to learn more innovative in order to be competitive.
China as inspiration for U.S. students. That's great. Thank you, Hing. Jim Fallows, how about it? Strong synergy here. You're writing recently that China's been taking advantage of the downturn to kind of brace and prepare for a next big advance in innovation, technology, all the rest. How do you see the relative economic
Both things can be true. I do actually agree with the spirit of the caller and most of the discussion we've been having on the show that potentially there are more areas for cooperation between China and the United States than there are areas of friction. And actually is remarkable considering the huge historic shift of world power that's going on with China's rise that should be so. It also, I think, is a crucial element to mention about these imbalances we've been discussing so often, because there's a tendency in the U.S. to view these as either purely predatory on China's part or purely sort of moral failing on the U.S. part.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they've been sort of complementary distortions in each economy. China has benefited by overproducing to create more jobs. We've benefited by overconsuming to have all the sort of benefits of daily life here. So both of them have been distorted, and both of them have this adjustment process to begin.
Shending Li, you've written recently that at least for the next 10 to 20 years, the U.S. position as sole superpower will not be challenged. But 10 or 20 years is not long in the sweep of history. Do you see China emerging as an American equal or in some ways already there?
Well, in terms of overall economic output, in official exchange rate, China is at this time 30% of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
At a bigger cost already of energy use, environmental degradation and ecological deterioration.
Mm.
The mode of China's development of this kind is questionable. But if China were to keep doing this at its environmental cost, certainly even with expected Chinese appreciation of the currency conversion with American U.S. dollar,
mm-hmm.
China, after 20 years, China may be on a par with the U.S. That, in my view, might not be sustainable.
Environmentally or ecologically?
For China's own damage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for per capita comparison, China at this time is only producing 7% of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And even when China is on par with the U.S., China would only produce on per capita level some 20% or 23% of the U.S. So it's way behind of the U.S. For a per capita level, for a century's time, basically it's hopeless for China to catch up. And China may never should aspire to catch up, because that would mean, without the technological innovation, a bigger burden on the Earth. So we need to find out a solution how China can legitimately enrich its own people without hurting its own ecology and damage, and how China-U.S. could work together to generate new energy-efficient technology, a new source of energy to preserve the Earth.
Susan Cherk, let's look at this issue, because greenhouse gases, climate change are likely to be very big on the agenda as well. The big conference is coming up in Copenhagen. The U.S. so far has not delivered a climate change bill to take to Copenhagen, and yet everybody says, as Shending Li does in Shanghai, that if China doesn't participate substantially in greenhouse gas reduction, we're all in trouble. How do you see that conversation going, Susan?
Well, certainly we don't go to China in the strongest position, having not really acted in a very decisive way in the United States on this global challenge. I think there's zero chance. I don't want to say that. That's too pessimistic. There's a very negligible chance that there's going to be some breakthrough agreement between China and the United States on climate change to take into Copenhagen. Chinese foreign ministry in particular is pretty hard over about refusing to take some national target, given that the United States and the other developed countries really are responsible for most of the carbon in the atmosphere today, and they're still putting most of it in on a per capita basis.
Mm.
So, this fairness issue that Shending Li very appropriately flagged really comes to a head when you talk about climate. And so I don't think there's going to be a big breakthrough agreement, but China's already doing a lot on the ground. And what we probably need to find a way to do is to cooperate to encourage those efforts, but we're not going to have a national target.
Jim Fallows, how do you see the climate change conversation here? You know, a lot of the talk in Washington has been, well, we're not going to commit to these reductions unless China and India do. On the other hand, if we all get stuck up on fairness, we can all fry together. How do you see it, Jim?
I think that certainly is the case. This is probably, it was evident to everybody that during the financial crisis starting a year ago, that if the United States and China didn't work together, really everybody was going down because the U.S. had the biggest economy, China had the largest sort of deployable reserves. I think something is even more true over a longer period of time about climate change issues, where if the U.S. and China can't find some way to get past the obvious fairness arguments and all the other sort of competitive and intellectual property aspects of this negotiation, which have been on the table, there really isn't any hope for anybody. Because China is probably now, by some estimates, putting out more greenhouse gases than the U.S. is. Whether or not that's true today, it'll be true a month from now or a year from now. And the two countries clearly have to find a way to work together on this front.
Chen-Ding Lei, I want to hear from you on that, but let's get a call here from Omaha, Nebraska, up the pike from you, Susan and Lincoln. Dennis is on the line. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. One thing I noticed about our climate thing is that we have more influence with our friends, in Japan and in Korea. And one thing that Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans share is an understanding of Confucius values. And lately, in the last decade or so, everyone there can see that we've kind of abandoned our friends who we have influence over on the ecology and the economy, and we've made friends with people who don't share our economic values. I had friends from China who go to college here, and they stayed 2 months too long, and the government took their house away for political reasons, right? People there aren't just taking our jobs. It's slaveholders taking our jobs. And when they take the jobs, they pollute more.
Dennis, let us pick up the gist of that. We're coming up on a break. But Jim Fallows, what about this notion that the U.S. is turning away from old friends, South Korea, Japan, toward the sort of sunshine of China's booming economy? What do you say, Jim?
I think with all respect, that's a little bit too bald a statement of what's going on there. The U.S. has interests and friendships with all the powers in that region, and in a complicated world, it needs to deal with Japan and China and Korea and Singapore and Indonesia and India and Australia and all the rest. So I think it's been an appropriately balanced response as opposed to kind of an either-or response the U.S. has had.
Chen-Ding Lei, is China happy for the U.S. to maintain its old alliances in Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, even as it grows closer to China inexorably?
There is a transformation of China's view in this regard. Well, decades ago, we might think that the U.S. Military stationing forward deployment in the region might be harmful to us. It could be good for Japan, because China has wants to have its national security, and if U.S. is deploying this force too close to China, China might be scared. When China was weak, when China remembers strongly the harm it has had over the past century. But now China is working with America collaboratively, positively, hugely on economic, on cultural exchange, on almost everything. China has been much more encouraged to take a new look at the positive, the other side of the U.S. interaction with its friend in the region. So China could see that why there are still some lingering harm of the U.S. presence in the region. The U.S. partnership with its friend in the region could also stabilize the region, bring us security. So China's view today is more complex and more balanced. So we do not totally view the negative side from a negative point of view.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's big trip to Asia. He's off today. And the U.S. agenda with China and its neighbors. Susan Shirk joins us from UC San Diego. She's with us today from Lincoln, Nebraska. James Fallows of The Atlantic Monthly, recently back from 3 years in China, a couple of decades spent covering East Asia, joins us from Washington, and from Shanghai in China, which will be President Obama's first stop there next week, Professor Shending Li of Fudan University's Institute of International Studies is with us. Let's get a call from Liberty Hill, South Carolina, and Patty. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My idea is I really think the Chinese should start producing, like, solar panels and things like that. It costs so much. Like, on my home, you know, I would have to borrow, I don't know, 20, you know, I've seen they say it takes up to $100,000 to make your house green. Well, you know, if I could afford it, I would do it in a minute. I would love to cut down on my power bill.
So make some cheap solar panels in China that you can afford in South Carolina, and you'll be happy. Jim Fallows, is that where we're headed?
Well, in fact, the world's leading producer of solar panels at this moment is China. And so what your caller's wish is being fulfilled. And I think this is both an opportunity and a challenge for the U.S. because if these green technologies are going to be a next big engine of growth, so to speak, then it's important for U.S.-based companies to be in this business too. But in the short term, more of these panels are coming out of China at a lower cost than any place else on Earth.
Susan Shirk, how does this work out to the U.S. advantage? Of course, it could cover more rooftops with solar and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But if the jobs making those panels are in China, how's it add up, Susan?
Yeah, this is a big dilemma. We saw it highlighted last week when a major wind farm is planned for the Southwest and they're going to buy their equipment from China. And in fact, the Chinese Development Bank, I believe, is even investing in the project. And Senator Schumer wrote a letter to the Steve Chu at the Department of Energy saying that in no way should any stimulus money be used to acquire equipment from China. So this is going to be a very difficult issue for the United States because, of course, it's good for us and for the whole world if China is producing green technologies, which we can all introduce and help save the planet. But then we get to these competitive issues and the jobs issues. So it's going to be very tough.
Shending Li, this may be a great example for us to talk about, to get your view from Shanghai on how these countries can balance their economic interests. You already pointed out China needs lots of jobs and economic growth just to keep up, 1.3 billion people. But at this point, it's very painfully clear that so does the United States need to create a lot of jobs. What can be done with this relationship to make it work for both countries so you've got employment, stability, and harmony on both sides?
Well, I have a few points. One is that the U.S. probably would see this for a significant amount of time in the future, that China would manufacture this low-cost but good-quality stuff. And American consumer would like to buy them because they are cheap and they are good quality. But at the same time, American would lose the opportunity to manufacture them inside America because India and China are more competitive in doing it. So my solution is twofold. One is America had to work harder on even high technology, to work on some things that Chinese and India may not be able to design, to invent, and save this job inside America. And second, when China more develops, China saves more wealth, China need to consume. The Confucius idea is that we should save the money. But I think we should take a post-Confucius idea that the purpose of earning money is to spend. So when China has more money, we have to spend to consume to live better life. We need to buy from outside of China. U.S. has sufficient stuff for China to buy. And Chinese people need to enrich themselves and change the consumption culture and has the courage to buy and to take some risk. Mm. This way, we could better strike a balance of trade and to make the country to have a win-win.
I'm sure Americans will be wondering about the timetable and all that. Unemployment's pretty high right here, right now. Let's get a call from Okemos, Michigan, and Lola. Lola, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to mention that sometimes I feel we're rather sabotaged by products from China because they look really pretty, but they don't hold up. And then we get toxic materials such as the drywall that mm-hmm. went to New Orleans mm-hmm. by the millions of dollars worth, mm-hmm. and tires that were cheap and embargoed from the U.S., and then they ship them in through Canada very shortly thereafter. And I'm sorry, I'm getting a little nervous about this, but...
No, we hear you loud and clear. I mean, people have expressed great concern about that. But what does it mean for the U.S. when it comes to the jobs and economy? There's a health issue if the drywall's bad. What about the economy, Lola?
Well, it's naturally taking jobs from our country. But also I have heard, and I don't know if it's true, that China sometimes uses the made in Thailand or such labels to disguise the products so that we won't resist those coming from China. And you can see that these are disrupting and causing losses to our economy.
Lola, so, let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more on that front from, and thanks there in Michigan, from Hudson, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air, Brian.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Well, what do you think?
Good, good. The difficulty becomes we're never going to be able to compete with China when it comes to manufacturing. And the reason is they don't have to pay the wages we have to pay. They don't have to put in the safety measures that we have to put in. And all of that costs money. And here in the United States, we like our earners to have those things, but we don't like to pay for it. You can't have those things without paying for it. So the cheaper goods come from China because you can pay the workers dirt, and you can't do that here. And until we figure out that we're going to have to pay for this, no matter what we do, there's not going to be equality because we're not willing to pay for it. We're cheap.
At home, we want that low-cost product, and these days people need it. Brian, thank you for your call. Jim Fellows, let me take these to you. Lola's concerned about products from China, you know, a good price, but look at poison drywall and other problems there. And Brian saying, how are we ever going to do this? Shending Li points a path, but it sounds kind of long-term.
Sure, and these are enormously complex issues, and I'll simply say this is essentially what my recent book is about. But I'll say that I've been to more than 100 factories in China. On the safety front, there's an enormous range there. If any of your listeners has a laptop computer right now, that was made in China. Whether it's Apple, whether it's Dell, whatever, it was made in China because that's where they're all made now. Mm. The standards of those are quite high, and they're imposed by foreign manufacturers who run their factories in the right way. There are a lot of factories in China which are just horrible, and where the pollution standards in China are bad, and then toxic standards are you know, there's all sorts of scandals all the time. So there is an enormous range within China, and the standards are largely set by foreign exporters who make things to a certain level or not. So that's something where we do have power to control them. On the whole economic balance, it is true that when you have a country where $100 a month is a very, very attractive wage for a young woman from the countryside. Mm. To try to compete on straight manufacturing with that kind of wage level from the developed world is not possible. And the way that Western firms have benefited over the last generation is essentially to use low-cost Chinese manufacturing for more, you know, for things that are designed in the U.S., branded in the U.S., or whatever. It's a very complex issue, complicated for all of us, which will just work out over the years to come with difficulties for everybody.
Susan Shirk, do you expect more problems on the trade front? The U.S., of course, put a 35% tariff on Chinese tire imports, as Lola was mentioning. China has hit back with some moves of its own. Are we going to see trade war? Is that possible here?
Well, I think our political leaders in both countries are going to work very hard to avoid that. And I think the Chinese response to tires was actually pretty moderate. Mostly they're going to the WTO. This is why we need the World Trade Organization to be a kind of fair court for these trade actions on the part of different countries. I think that the trade issues, though, will continue to be difficult to manage for all the reasons we're talking about this morning.
Let's get a call from Madison, Wisconsin. Habu, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Just a quick word, and that is that the United States is increasingly becoming irrelevant on the world stage. And let me just give a very simple example. The stimulus package in China is having a greater effect on reviving that economy than what we are doing here. We are floundering and dithering. And dare I say, I believe in free trade, but not the kind that we have seen eviscerate and devastate Main Street America. It's about time that the United States puts up some barriers so that people in America, if they're going to compete with Chinese, can compete on a level footing.
Habu, thanks very much for your call. Shinding Li, what do you say to that kind of concern? We've had it in several calls there. You've described a path toward maybe balancing this relationship economically over time, but it can look like a long time to Americans. Chinese leaders must be thinking about that.
Well, I think all the points made make sense. China should take these points seriously, and we need to take care of this concern. And we should increase with the pace of our development, the salary of our workers, the safety standard of their working environment, and also the other strengths concerning their working condition and human rights, and including to improve the preservation level of environment. And this way, our production may be on a more fair level to compare with America. And even if American were to lose some job, American workers might feel that it's acceptable. At the same time, I want to make the point that why some American workers lost their job. Actually, part of the reason is that U.S. investors, they came to China to bring the labor opportunity to China, and they make money. While they generate the wealth inside China, they share the wealth with the Chinese workers and the government. Probably the investors, they have taken a big chunk out of the new wealth. Mm. So America overall still win. But the division, the distribution of the new wealth might not be fair among American citizens. Those investors, they might benefit through such a globalization. While the workers at home, they win when they pay less to buy the same goods, but they have a greater chance to lose their job. Hmm. So they are more in a dilemma situation. So we have to take all these factors into consideration.
Interesting. Puts it back in the American lap there again from another angle. Let's get a call from Victoria, Marlborough, Massachusetts. Victoria, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I know this may seem totally radical and coming from another vantage point, but I'm wondering if once again the U.S. is missing the opportunity to skin this cat a different way, and that is, why don't we consider, and I'm absolutely serious about this, broaching China and North Korea to help us rid Afghanistan from the horrible terrorist, giving us some of our men and women back, making them whole again, and then giving them, China, North Korea, an opportunity to realize that we respect what they've got, wonderful amounts of resource, human beings and soldiers, and they're very good at war, and then go to them about joining us at the table for an overarching global goal of the carbon footprint.
But start maybe with Afghanistan. That's interesting. Sort of what even hand it off to China. Susan Shirk, is there some room on the China front? I mean, China's nearby. China has big interests in that part of the world. They're looking at very large investments there in minerals and more. Is it possible that President Obama might find some backstop in China with Pakistan, Afghanistan, all the rest?
Well, I think they will be talking about that because China is a neighbor and China feels at risk from Islamic extremism and terrorism. They have a big problem in Xinjiang. And so I think they will be talking about that, and it would be quite a wonderful gesture for China to contribute in some way to the effort in Afghanistan. Of course, once upon a time, a few decades ago, U.S. and China were both, believe it or not, supporting the Taliban against the Soviets. So there is a precedent for that. And, of course, the Chinese now also are participating in the global fight against piracy. They've sent naval vessels to the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Africa. So they are participating in that effort, and they do participate in a lot of United Nations peacekeeping.
Jim Fallows, let me just ask you, our time is short. President Obama is going to talk with young Chinese, I think, in Shanghai. He's famously been pretty popular around the world. What about the Obama, I don't know, charisma, charm? Does it work in China, Jim, to your eye?
You know, as I understand that, and Professor Shun may know this more up to date than the rest of us, I think that session is in question now, whether or not they'll be able to agree on the rules. But I think that in the build-up to the U.S. election, Obama was probably less exciting in China than in many other countries, just because there was a more premium on stability in the U.S., and I think also a slight racial factor, where the Chinese weren't as accustomed to the idea of a non-white leader for the U.S., but he seems certainly to be popular among the young people there now, and so I think if this can work out, it would likely be very effective, as Bill Clinton's session with students was back during his time in office.
Shen-Ding Liu, we only have half a minute. Is that meeting still on with the Chinese youth or not?
Yes, I think it's still planned next Monday. And I think our students are encouraged. I hope there will be a good discussion.
We'll all hope for that. They're the future, along with their counterparts here in the U.S. and right around the region and the world. Shen-Ding Liu with Fudan University. In Shanghai, thank you for staying up so late to be with us, and thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Shen.
Thank you very much.
James Fallows with the Atlantic Monthly. It's always great to talk with you, Jim. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Susan Shirk, UC San Diego, joining us today from Lincoln, Nebraska. Susan Shirk, thanks for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.